the field, turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday, presented by Bullet Train. Bullet Train. Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station. Now, here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
And once again, welcome to this Trainer Talk edition of the Final Furlong Show, all presented by Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. We do welcome everybody just joining us across the country on Sirius Channel 93, and all of you who have been with us for the past 3 hours on XM Channel 209, tuning into a special replay show of our past three Trainer Talk shows. It's been a lot of fun to do this over the past several weeks, and we hope you enjoyed that over the course of the past 3 hours. And Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and JT, another big show on tap for tonight.
Yeah, this is great. Michael Matz joining us in the first half hour, a fantastic trainer, wonderful guy, a hero, all these great things that he's done in his career, including winning the Kentucky Derby.
Winning the Kentucky Derby, winning the Belmont Stakes, and winning the Breeders' Cup Distaff with Round Pond. So he's been in the spotlight on several different occasions, and he's nice enough to spend some time with us here today. Michael, thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Michael, when you hear that resume, 548 wins, your runners have earned more than $29 million, Barbaro, Union Rags, Round Pond, do you ever just sit back and go, wow, I can't believe this has all happened?
Well, when you have horses like that, you just keep looking for another one and hope you'll get one. That's the hard part. They're here, you know, 1 minute and next minute. It's really kind of a roller coaster ride that you have in this business. So you have to enjoy it as well as you can.
Well, Michael, we'll spend plenty of time talking about those horses, but take us back to the beginning. You grew up in Reading, Pennsylvania. How'd you get involved with racing and even go back a little bit further than that? Because I know that your love of horses goes back to when you were a kid.
Well, it kind of started with a funny situation. My father's a plumber, and I used to work every summer with him, just to get a job every time when I was out of school. I would work every summer for my father, and then he got me a job on the weekends cutting grass at a farm that was probably about 10 miles away, and a friend of his, and so I would work all summer, and I was just trying to earn some money and, you know, make things work out. And he ended up getting some horses and for him and his wife to ride. And he said to me, "Do I know how to ride?" And I just kind of said, "Oh, sure." And never realizing that he'd want me to ride. But it started there where, I would go for little trail rides with him. And his when his wife didn't go with him, I would go with him for a little trail ride. And sort of one thing led to another, and I got interested in horses, and I ended up, you always pick the goal that's quite high for yourself, and I didn't know it at this point. I first went into the pony club, and I was at the age 16 or 17 years old, where most kids are, 10, 11, 12 years old going in the pony club, so I didn't kind of fit in that aspect about the age group and everything, but I did seem to learn pretty fast about what was expected, and I did enjoy working with the animals. So one thing led to another, and then I had a very nice career in the show jumping. When that ended at the point where, I didn't, I quit in 2000. I had a commitment to the Olympic Games in Sydney. And I just had some young horses at the time that were very good, but they weren't, at that point experienced enough to do the Olympics, maybe 4 years later. But I thought at that point it was a good time for me to retire from that. And I had a couple choices to end up, whether I wanted to give lessons and teach younger riders, which I don't mind doing. It's just I didn't feel like I could stand in a ring all the time and do stuff like that. I felt like I wanted to work with the horses more, and I started with a racing stable. And it was a little hard at one point, going from maybe the top 20% in that discipline in show jumping, going to the bottom 20% in the other. But yep. It was a challenge, and I've been very lucky with the show jumping and the race horses that I've always been involved with some very good owners.
Yeah, we talked to Carl Nasker last week, and he talked about that, going from a rodeo king to a guy with five horses at a little track. So the culture shock is immense, but you certainly made the best of it.
Well, I mean, it's like anything. If you want something bad enough, and if you work hard enough about it, you'll usually get it.
Michael, you described your career as a rider as a very nice career. I think you're far too humble. When you take a look at your accomplishments as a rider on the Olympic equestrian team, just some of the accolades: 8 Pan American Game medals in 4 competitions, including 5 golds. You rode in the 3 world championships where you won the team gold medal as well as the team and individual bronze medals. Your career as a rider was almost unparalleled, and I think that it's so unique because we don't see horse trainers coming from that discipline in this sport and get to the top of the training regimen too, like you've done it.
Well, like I say, it really is. I mean, there are so many good horsemen and so many good riders. You just have to be, lucky enough to get a good horse that can, good horses make good riders and good horses make good trainers. So, it doesn't matter, everybody sort of has a little bit different way they go about it, but, a good horse is a good horse. And, whether it's jumping, we were just watching a video of top steeplechase horse in England. I think it was something Keiko Star or something like that. And mm-hmm. They're turning him into a dressage horse. So it's pretty amazing what kind of athletes these horses are.
Well, you've certainly had your share of good ones. Talk about when you first started training and maybe some of the clients that helped you along the way and got you going.
Well, one of the who I had the show jumpers for was Mr. and Mrs. Dixon. That's who I rode. I rode their horse in the 1972 Olympics Grande, and then 1976, and then I rode their horse again 20 years later in the Atlanta Olympics. So they were, and he also had race horses. And when I did stop with the show horses, he was very, very, helpful in that manner. Mrs. Groves, my mother-in-law, Mrs. Moran, my sister-in-law, Helen Alexander, who runs who ran the King Ranch division. Now she has her own farm, Middlebrook. They were always very good. And, my whole family that way were very supportive of me. And, they did have their trainers, but they would always, Emery, my other sister-in-law, she'd always send me a horse or two. So it was very nice because these were the people that I knew in the with the show jump and help me again with that. But I would say, and obviously when I got the horses for the Jacksons and who owned Barbaro, they were, very, responsible for a lot of nice horses that I had.
And Michael, you said a good horse is a good horse, whether it's a show horse or a race horse. Is there some crossover there? Have there been some things that you learned as an Olympic rider that had helped you in training horses as well?
Well, I think that just the fact of being around the horses and being able to ride. One of the hard things for me is now is in training race horses when I keep the jockey up there. And for one thing, I'm not sure if he understands what you say. And a lot of the, obviously the good ones are top jockeys that you don't have to say anything to them. But sometimes in some of these horses that you know, have a little quirk and you're trying to explain to a jockey and maybe he might not speak English very well or something like that. It can get a little bit to the point where you're absolutely not sure of what, you know, if you're getting the point across or not. But I do think a lot of things that I did do in the show horses, you know, you just have to take forward with. It's done a little bit differently with the race horses. Things have to go a little bit faster in the morning than normally, but it's always things that you can adapt to.
Trainer Michael Matz, our special guest here on the Final Furlong Trainer Talk Show, all presented by Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. And Michael, you mentioned your wife, Dorothy. She has some unbelievable ties to some legendary names in the game. You referred to your mother-in-law. Talk about their family and some of the things they've been able to accomplish in the industry.
Well, obviously, through the years with my mother-in-law's father, Mr. Clayburg, and, you know, he's had I never got a chance to meet him, but his reputation, you know, goes on that, you know, he's just a very charismatic man and just, you know, loved the game and, you know, what he did in the cattle business and what he did in the racehorse business, you know, it speaks for itself. But they've been very helpful. Helen ran the King Ranch, and then when that dissolved for the racehorses, all of them had, Mrs. Groves had her own horses, and Emery and Edie and Helen had their own horses, and sometimes it's in partnership, but, you know, Mrs. Groves grew up, you know, on a ranch, and she's a very good horsewoman, and she has some great ideas, and, you know, it's just nice to be involved with owners like that that really understand the sport, and, you know, when it's, you need to give them a rest, they give them a rest. They don't press on, and it's just nice, you know, with people like that to train for.
Well, Michael, you've obviously been very blessed with your family, also blessed, as you mentioned, with some great owners and some great horses throughout your career. Let's fast forward to 2006 and focus on Barbaro going down that road. Talk about the highest highs and the lowest lows. We hear that expression a lot in racing. You experienced all of those in the span of about 7 or 8 months with Barbaro.
Yeah, he you know, obviously we never got to see how good Barbaro really was with his accident, but we had his younger brother called Holy Ground, was a real nice horse, and he ended up to be a minor stakes winner. And all they kept telling us is, wait till you see his little brother. Well, the little brother came, and he wasn't so little. And he was, you know, from day one, you wouldn't, I mean, he ate every oat. He did what you asked him to do. He loved to gallop in the morning. Maybe the worst thing he was, maybe coming back from the track, he would always jig back to the track, but it was nothing that ever stayed with him that went along. I mean, he did absolutely everything we want him to do from his first start, which he ran at Delaware. We were going to run him even if it was on the dirt or the turf, but it came up that the race came up on the turf and the timing was good, so we ran him there. And then at that point, the timing was good. I think it was 5 or 6 weeks later to the Laurel Futurity. That came up very well, and that was on the turf. And when we ran him down here in the Tropical Park Derby, was on the turf. He ran so well, and I said to Peter, my assistant, I said, you know, we better, he's always worked well on the dirt, but we never got a chance, you know, it just didn't work that way. And the way everything, the timing of all those other races, we just stayed with him at the turf. And I said to him, you know, I said, we would sure look pretty stupid if we didn't try him on the dirt at this point. He's done everything we've asked him to do, and he's only has one chance to win the Derby. But nothing ever went out of line what we were doing with him. Everything went completely in order, and you know, we tried the Holy Bull that came up sloppy, and he still won that. And at that point, we said, well, there were still people that were skeptical about could he run on the dirt or not, the way he moved. And he ran a terrific race, I thought, in the Florida Derby. And that was the only time he ever got tested. And the horse came to him, and he fought back. But he galloped out so well. And after that couple weeks, he was like a different horse. I mean, he just, I don't know if he was proud of himself or if he was just, he just liked the competition. But at that point, we decided to give him a rest. And I don't know why all the people from the media, the journalists, gave me such a hard time about waiting 6 weeks before we run him in the Derby. And but a lot of his other races were timed like 5 and 6 weeks. So I didn't see, and I spoke with a lot of people and asked them, what they thought. I spoke with some jockeys. I spoke with Edgar, the Jacksons. I told them what we wanted to do, what we thought was best for the horse. And, they were, great that way about, whatever you think is best for the horse, you do that. And, but the journalists really, gave me a hard time about, I guess I shouldn't have been worried about it, but
yeah, it turned out you had the last laugh.
Well,
but anyway, and all the trainers, what I talked to, and they always said, just your last work. And we were at Keeneland working him, and Peter, my assistant, was riding him all the time. And he worked him. His last work was as good a work as I've seen a horse work. And before I got off the pony, my phone was ringing. And I don't even, to this day, I don't know who it was. There was a man that called me that was they said he was an old clocker from Churchill. And he said, son, I hadn't seen a horse work like that in many, many years. So that made me feel good to hear something like that. And, he just went into the Derby like he ran into the Derby. So I guess he was trying to tell us something then, but, he was a wonderful horse.
Well, I was so taken with him in the Holy Bull, in the mud that day. Mike and I happened to be doing a show down there. And it was a sensational race, and he continued on, and one thing that I've learned doing these trainer talk shows is that the really good trainers do what they think's right by the horse, and they don't worry about what everybody else says. Journalists ought to stick to typewriters and pencils, because everybody's got an opinion in racing, but the guys that really excel, like yourself, they know their animals and they do the right thing. And it's a continuing theme on these shows that trainers will say, well, a lot of people said I should do this or that, but I really thought the horse needed to do this. And hats off to you for sticking to your guns.
Well, one of the things that, and when you're getting back to what happened in my show horse career was the first time I rode in the Olympics was in 1976 in Montreal. And our team was, I would say it was a young team, and our coach didn't tell us who was going to ride in this and who was going to ride in that. And every time that we would have a little school getting ready for the games, we were competing against our own team. And I went away from those Olympics, and it ended up that everybody got a chance to ride. There were 5 members. I didn't ride in the individual, but I did ride in the team competition. And my horse absolutely was, he went past his prime, and we had a nice round, but I'll never forget it. I had the first round, I think I had 20 faults or 24, and the second round I had 24 or 28. And my horse just jumped like he was past his prime. And I don't think I would have done anything different except train my horse better to go into the competition as a fresh horse instead of a horse that was past his prime. And so many times when I was training Barbaro, and Peter and I spoke about this, is that, you know, I don't want to go to the Kentucky Derby or any of those big races unless I have a horse that I feel that can be a competitor. And not just to say that I've had a horse that I trained in the Kentucky Derby. And I thought Barbaro was a horse that really had a big, big chance to win. And that's why we gave him the same time in between races that we gave him before, because he was obviously undefeated at that point. Well, we did, so there was no reason to change anything different. So in that aspect, for what happened in Montreal, was a good learning experience for Barbaro and the Kentucky Derby.
Michael, one of the other sidebars or side stories to that 2006 Kentucky Derby actually involved what had to be the most horrific incident of your life on July 19th, 1989, when the crash landing of United Flight 232 in Iowa, and you were on that flight. You miraculously survived unscathed. Jude referred to you as a hero when we came on the air today. You actually went in and rescued survivors, three of those being children, Jody, Melissa, and Travis Roth. They were there 17 years later as your special guest at the Kentucky Derby. Just a remarkable story and a true hero for sure.
Well, we were talking the other day about this. It's a different situation for people, and God forbid you get in that situation, then nobody knows how you're going to react to that or something like that. But, thank God that it did work out well, and everybody, at least the kids, and not everybody, but we did get out there with our lives. So that was a blessing in that fact. But I think they're doing good. My wife stays in touch with their parents. From what I heard, they're all three of them are doing well.
How'd they enjoy that Derby experience?
They liked it. They had a good time.
I wrote an article about the girls from Lael that were all in their little pretty dresses and they were chanting, you know, come on, Barbaro. And you ran an entry that day. Who was the other horse?
The entry was Barkley Tag trained it. It was
Showing Up. Was that it?
Showing up.
Yeah. Well, they were singing, "Come on, Barbaro, come on, Showing Up, come on, Barbaro." And after the race, they all went crazy. Except one little girl said, "I wanted Showing Up to win."
Oh, I didn't hear that story, but they all seemed pretty happy. That's for sure.
Well, they all went down to get their picture taken or whatever. But it was so funny. You can't please everybody, even when you win the Derby.
Oh, you can't. That's for darn sure. But they seemed pretty happy that day. I know everybody was. So it was a great experience, that's for sure.
Michael, you then had the privilege of training a couple of full brothers to Barbaro, Nicanor and Lentinor. Excuse me. Talk about that experience when they come into your barn and after the big horse. It has to be kind of a thrill, and the expectations are immense.
Well, yeah, we all were. You know, they all were real nice horses, that's for sure. They just were not, it was, the standard was set pretty high by Barbaro, and they were all, they were all real nice horses. They just weren't as good as he was. And so you hope they can. Nicanor was very fast. He was very difficult temperament-wise. If he would have relaxed a little bit more, I think he would have been, a really, really nice horse, and he was a very well-built horse, but he just was not, he was just a little bit leery about everything, and the way he kind of got about that, he had a tremendous amount of speed, but he just, he was always constantly, one to do his job, which was great, but it was hard for him to relax, and Lentinor ended up to be a stakes winner, and I think they're both standing at stud. One is in Maryland, and one is in Kentucky right now.
Well, Michael, just a couple of minutes left. It's hard to believe it's been a half an hour already, flown by. We always like to end the interviews by letting our listeners know a little bit more about what trainers enjoy when they're not at the racetrack. What are some of the hobbies outside of racing that you're involved with and some of the things you like to do when you have those few minutes that you're not at the racetrack?
Well, we have 6 children, so they keep me busy right there. And just, right now, 3 of them are riding. My 2 oldest children are, my oldest son plays polo, and my oldest daughter just had a baby. And then the 4 younger ones, 3 of them ride. So we do, I like to, go watch them, and see what they're doing. And then my second oldest son liked golf too. So, I started to play golf, and I guess that's all you can call it, play it. I'm not very good at it. But, he likes to go out. So it's just nice to be with them. And, we end up doing stuff. The youngest one likes to fish. So usually different things like that when, we go out. That's good enough with me to be with the kids.
Well, that's a fantastic way to do it, and it's nice that they have varied interests. You can do a little bit of everything.
No, it's fun. It's at one point, the 2 youngest ones wanted to ride motorcycles, and you know how it's funny. They did on these little motorcycles. They did it pretty well, but now all of a sudden all the motorcycles just sit in the garage. They don't do anything.
That's probably a good thing.
That's probably a good thing, is right. You got that one right.
Well, Michael, this has been a lot of fun. Really appreciate you taking the time, and it's been great to hear your story here on Trainer Talk. Thank you so much.
All right, my pleasure.
All right, we'll see you in Florida.
Okay, bye.
All right, Trainer Michael Matz. Boy, great stories there, and a true hero. You're absolutely right.
The guy's amazing. He's had an amazing life.
David Fox coming up next on the second half of Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on HRN.
You're listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on HRN. Bullet Train, it's time to get on board.
Group-winning Bullet Train, the sensational three-quarter brother to the amazing racehorse Frankel, has captured the hearts and dreams of everyone who's seen him. Handsome and correct, he was precocious enough to win his debut at 2 with a massive 113 time form rating. Bullet Train had the speed American breeders seek and the class to defeat 11 horses who won or placed in a Group 1. And his pedigree, well, being bred by Judmont Farm, says it all. This year, Bullet Train joins Montjou and Galileo as top sons of Sadler's Wells at stud. He stands at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky, for a $7,500 stud fee. For more information, call Sean Feld at 859-519-9665. Bullet Train has arrived at the station. It's time to get on board.
You can be a better bettor just by knowing how a horse is working.
For the first time ever, RacingWithBruno.com's reports are available straight from the source.
Racing with Bruno's With the Works takes you behind the past performances into the morning routines that matter most.
With over 20 years of experience, our team of analysts specialize in first-time starters and layoff horses, as well as full-card workout reports and selections.
Go to RacingWithBruno.com.
Now with the works.
Imagine having 80 channels of live, full-card, uninterrupted simulcast feeds delivered direct to your home television for just $50 a month. Choose from your favorite thoroughbred, harness, quarter horse, and greyhound tracks in North America and internationally. Call Dish Network at 1-888-677-5487 and ask for RTN, the Racetrack Television Network. RTN is the only place where you can see every race from every simulcast every day.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
This is HRRN, your exclusive home for Kentucky Derby 139.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, all presented by Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, an enjoyable visit in the first half of the show with trainer Michael Matz, and now we turn our attention to another person who is based down in Florida, and that's our good friend David Fox, nice enough to visit with us here for a little bit, tell us his story, and this undoubtedly the first time and maybe the only time we're ever going to do an interview like this. David joining us from off the coast of Florida in a fishing boat, doing a little fishing, but the fishing is kind of slow. So he said, what the hell? We'll talk to these guys for about a half an hour. David, thanks so much.
Thank you. No problem. What's going on?
Sorry, the fishing's so slow.
Yeah, it's okay. We saw some bait jumping, so we think maybe there's some dolphin behind it. Well, hopefully we'll get lucky and maybe pick one of those up.
Now, what are you actually fishing for?
Sailfish, anything that swims, basically. We're trying for some sails right now. So we had the dolphin, the kind that the fish
mahi mahi
chasing some bait here. Mahi mahi, right? So we're hoping to get lucky and pick one of those up.
Now, where are you? Are you off the coast?
Off of Cavender Creek in the Keys.
Okay. Nice.
I'm probably ratting myself out. You're both the only people that know, and I've told the world.
Well, that's all right. There's no racing today, so you're safe.
That's right. I'm safe. That's right.
Well, David, obviously fishing, one of your big hobbies, probably your biggest hobby outside of racing. But let's talk about your story and how you got started in racing. Take us back to the beginning.
Well, when I was about 16, a gentleman that was a friend of my father's used to teach riding lessons at our farm. We had a riding academy. And at a Christmas Eve, or a New Year's Eve party, he just said one day, he said, you're kind of small. You want to go to the racetrack and be a jockey? And I started the next morning, 1976, and I've been there ever since.
Wow.
Went from riding hunters and jumpers to, I was on the track the next morning galloping horses. And in fact, I worked at Washington Park. That was my first day, and it burnt down the next day.
Oh, wow.
That's a great start.
Yeah, right. So then I was in Chicago, so we went from Washington to Hawthorne, sportsman's meet there, and then to Arlington. And by the time I got to Arlington, I rode my first race.
How'd that work out?
It was only a matter of about 3 months, and I was working part-time on the track at that point.
So did you ride many races?
I rode 40. I got to win a couple. I accidentally won my first race.
Well, that's the best way.
And that was at Arlington?
That was at Arlington, yeah. The trainer thought the horse might need a race and just got lucky, and she was fitter than he thought, and she found the winner's circle.
What was the name of the...
Surprised everybody, including myself. I was hanging on for dear life.
What was the name of the horse, and who was the trainer?
The guy's name was Don Gibbons, and the horse's name was Scary Mary.
Scary Mary. Well,
appropriate.
Scary Mary.
Talk just a second about the difference between like riding hunters and jumpers and racehorses and how fit you have to be to ride a racehorse.
Riding a racehorse doesn't compare at all to the hunters and jumpers as far as fitness goes. You really have to ride a race to really appreciate how fit jockeys are. I mean, they're very, very fit athletes because to stand up in those stirrups, while they're, running like that, it's you got to be extremely fit. So,
David, has that helped you with training horses now, having that experience of knowing them?
It gave me a little bit of advantage. You know, when you're watching a race and you know, when a rider comes back and wants to tell you something you don't really believe, you know, or whatever. I mean, I think it gives you advantage of watching a race. But it's like, it's experience. You know, I'm off, like I said, we're offshore fishing, and the captain on the boat, he sees stuff we don't even see. And it's the same with the horse, you know, the horse races. We see things during a race that the average, you know, maybe patron or person or whatever doesn't see.
Yeah.
You know, you say, oh, you see that? And they go, no, what'd you see?
Yeah.
You know? And I think experience gives you, you know, the most, you know, the time gives you the most experience.
People always look at horses training in the morning, like at those workout programs they have at Gulfstream and stuff, and the trainer will be watching their horse, and they'll be, you know, 50, 100 horses on the track, and they go, how do you know which horse is yours? You know?
Yeah.
And it's just like a second nature thing to a trainer, but to the average person, they're like in awe that you could find your horse out there.
It really is. And, you know, a lot of it, it's like a school teacher. How do they know, you know, within the first couple of days of the class, they know every single kid, and they know everything about them. You know, and it's the same thing. No, you're no different than a school teacher.
Yeah,
you know, when you're dealing with very young pupils.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, some of the, I treat them like they're little kids, because that's what they are. When they come to the track, they're babies. And they're 2 years old. They're going to live to be 25. You're in the first 10% of their life. And you've got them out there galloping and training, and you're trying to teach them.
So when did you officially make the decision to hang up your boots and stop riding, and then go ahead and start training horses?
Shortly after I went into Sportsman's Park Stewart's office, and I told him I needed to take out my jockey's license again, and they looked at me and said, you're kind of big, aren't you, boy? unfortunately, I was the comment in the forum when I won my first race was, too big fox wins on first mount. So I was always kind of large for trying to be a rider.
Who was the when you made the switch from riding to training, who were some of the people that kind of helped you along the way?
Do you know, it's funny, when I first, I started like shortly after I quit riding, I got my trainer's license, took my test, got my trainer's license, and there was a guy named Scott Hollis, and Scott, who trains in Chicago now, a very low profile guy, he had a few horses, and he was a trainer at the time. He was still working for his father's asphalt company, and that's what they owned out of Illinois. And I had a couple horses for them. And actually, you know who Christine Jenks is? Her mm-hmm. husband, Barry. Barry hadn't even met Christine, and him and his father had a little bit of money, and they bought a couple horses. And I won a couple races for him, and then, you know, I started galloping horses more, and I kind of lost those horses, and got, you know, young kid, got to party and having too much fun. And mostly galloped horses, was a vet's assistant trainer for about the next 15 years, until I got to Florida, and a guy named Dr. Frazier, Pyrite Stable, gave me an opportunity to start again. So there was probably a 15-year gap from when I first got my license till I really got serious. And at that point of 1976, I got my first horses, and we've been very fortunate ever since that point.
Who was your first winner?
I had a filly named, I believe her name was Inside Job. She won like in 1978, won with her. But when I started again, Dr. Frazier, I had a little filly for him named Dinner Speaker, a little form of dinner filly. I mean, she was really the start. I mean, like I said, 15 years later before I probably sell another winner.
Well, you had that time to basically go to school, work for some people, learn the ropes a little more.
I worked for a guy named Butch Richards. I worked for Christine Jenks. I worked for Dr. Birch as a vet's assistant. You know, there was a period where I worked in the jocks room at Belmont Park as a valet, saddled horses. And, you know, I kind of got a well-rounded experience. You know, I got to do a little bit of everything.
Yeah, and all those things help you down the line when it comes time to make decisions and stuff. You have all those experiences in that background, and you can, you know, really focus in on what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. I hustled, I worked on, for selling feed and selling bedding. And I mean, I did everything between the period that I first, came on the racetrack and really got a shot to get a group of horses put together. And once Dr. Frazier gave me that break, it really helped me. At that point, it just grew. I mean, it wasn't long after I first started, I had 41 carats, and that really, that was a good boost. Shot in the arm, and it's been growing ever since.
Was 41 carats your first big horse?
He was my first big horse, yeah.
What do you remember about him when you look back on him?
He was fast. He was a little crazy, but he was some kind of fast. He was a funny horse. I remember seeing a comment in the racing form that, before the Derby, he was like number 22 on the list. And Walter, who Buddy knew, great guy. He's passed now. But he wanted to go, he said, let's go to the Derby. Let's go on up there, get the experience, give the horse the experience, even if we don't run. And we didn't get in, but it was a good experience. But I remember him saying the horse train was still ponying and training nervously. Well, that horse almost never had a saddle on except to graze. Yeah, as soon as you brought the tack to him, he got very fractious, and he was high maintenance that way. He was tough to deal with. But if you could get him over there, keep his head on straight, he could really run.
Well, that's one of those things
he holds a track record at Meadowlands, he went a mile and eighth in 1:45.2, kick off the world record, and then. And then again, a call to go 3/4 of a mile, 108, which is track record that'll probably never be broke.
Yeah, 108 at Calder's like running 106 someplace else.
Yeah, I mean, he was a really nice horse.
Speaking of Calder, David, you're obviously based in South Florida year-round. Why the decision to go to South Florida and to Calder year-round?
Well, actually, at that time, I met a girl and we got married, and I was working for Happy Altar. As an assistant trainer, which fortunately that only lasted 60 days, and then once I got down there, now we're married and we've got a house, and I just I left periodically. I went back to Illinois very briefly, but I love it down here. There's nowhere in the world in the middle of February you're gonna be able to be offshore fishing and raise a family and do what you want to do and stay in one place. And it looked like that was going to fall apart on us. But now with, Gulfstream stepping into the game like they are, it looks like we're going to race you around here at Gulfstream.
Yeah, that's going to be really nice for the trainer, Simon.
I'm really excited about it because, going to the horsemen's meetings and stuff like that, I've learned so much about what they're planning on doing. I mean, they've got some great ideas. I mean, I think if it's ever going to happen, Gulfstream Park's going to make it happen.
Trainer David Fox, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And David, you mentioned your wife, Celia. She's also involved with your operation. You have your daughter, Natalie. Not sure how involved she is, but talk about your family and their involvement with what you do.
Well, my wife, she goes in the morning and, she exercises. She keeps an eye on the books. She's diligent about our feed program. I think our feed program is second to none. We really focus on that with the horses because, more so in the summertime when it's hot, it's a little trickier to keep these horses in the feed tub the way you want them eating. And she really tries to stay up on that. She's always reading some articles about, the best way to feed a racehorse and, again, she does the books and, keeps track of all the money I'm wasting.
Gives you a little fishing allowance, huh?
And my daughter, she's more involved big time in the hunters and jumpers now. She just loves it. And that's been good because my wife is also heavily involved in the South Florida Horse Rescue. And it's called Florida Track. And she's got, 20 or 25 head at a farm right now that she's overseeing. Plus, I believe they've got 180 horses waiting for adoption right now.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and they're always, always chasing, you know, trying to help people get horses placed and stuff as the horses get retired.
That's a great project.
Because they're not going to race forever, and it's nice to be able to, you know, have an outlet where they can retire and they go with a lifetime contract. These horses, they're really looked after even when they're adopted. The program keeps track of them throughout their lives.
Fantastic! That's a great undertaking, and congratulations to your wife for putting out all that effort. That's a tremendous thing to do for our business. The first time we met you, you were so gracious and took us around your barn and showed us all of your nice horses, and we met your wife, and you told us a great story about traveling to a race and how you and your wife just hopped in the pickup truck and took the two horse and drove the horse. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, we've done it a couple times. One time we went to Oaklawn Park. We put Duke of Mischief, who's retired right now. In fact, I just retired him in the last few days. He was great. I mean, he was one of them kind of horses you could just do. I have a four horse gooseneck, and we would open up and make a big box stall for him in there, and he would get on, and he would actually eat on the van. And we went to Oakland Park, and we won the Oakland Handicap, which was wonderful because Mr. Lieblong's first stake win in Arkansas, where he's based. So it was a great experience. And a few months later, we did it again. We went to Charlestown, and we won the Charlestown Classic $1 million pot with the same horse.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, it's nice to see that, there's trainers that can do that. A lot of trainers that would never undertake such a trip. And, of course, you and your wife work so closely together. It's really fantastic, and you're to be admired.
It gives you a little time away, too. It's nice. We've actually had a lot of fun doing it because you go to these towns, there's a lot to do at them, believe it or not. And we got an opportunity to meet the racing secretaries and go out to them and see these I forget the name of the place in Virginia, a small town in Virginia we went to and had lunch. And there's plenty to do. And, Oaklawn, that area's got a lot of history and, beautiful area. So it's really a lot of fun.
David, didn't you do the same thing with Big Drama when he went to Saratoga?
Yeah, actually, my wife went with me one time, and then a friend of mine, Bill Finney, went with me another time. And
do we want to tell those stories?
Which one is it?
Do we want to tell the stories about going up with Bill Finney? On the, I'm sure there's some stories about that trip.
There's usually always a good story. It's just we're trying to remember them all.
Tell us about Big Drama. Obviously, he's a horse that most people will probably recognize, David Fox and Big Drama together. He's kind of become your signature horse. Talk about him and his career and kind of the early days. Take us all the way through.
Well, I'll be honest. Early days, we had a string at Delaware Park. My assistant, Don Stetler, he was at Delaware at the time. And Celia was I called her, and I was running back and forth, and she kept calling me and saying, "Man, we got this 2-year-old that can really run." I said, "Really? They come out of the blue." And she said, "Yeah, I really like this horse." So at the time, we had Duke and Bishop getting ready, too, and they were kind of work partners. And Duke would outwork him 1 week, and he would come back and outwork Duke. And they were always, like, right next to each other as far as workouts. And I ran both horses the same day, and I was so disappointed. I ran. There was a 6.5 and a 6, and I thought Duke had a little more speed. Well, I was wrong. I ran Big Drama 6.5, and he made the lead easy and opened up a couple and just faded the last 16th and ended up third. And Duke, not breaking quite as well, laid back and made a little run and finished third also. So Duke went home and had a vacation after that, and Big Drama was just history after that. I mean, he just, he won his next out very convincingly, swept the Florida Stallion Stakes. We took him to, back on the road again, the Delta Jackpot, which me and Celia went to. Unfortunately, that time we had a carrier take us, but Celia actually went with the carrier and on a private van, the Delta. And we won that, and he's been a lot of fun. We've taken him to Saratoga, and he's the kind of horse you can just put on a band, and he goes. And I said, with me?
Yeah, we're riveted.
And I'll tell you what was really fun when after we won the Breeders' Cup, the day after that, we brought the trailer up to the barn, and all the cameras there watching us, loading them on my little horse, my little horse van, and off we went back to Miami with the Breeders' Cup winner.
That's a classic.
That experience, winning the Breeders' Cup, winning it the way he did, just so sensational. That had to be an incredible experience and an incredible ride for you.
Oh, it was unbelievable. What the neat thing was about the whole thing was never going to a Breeders' Cup. I galloped for a guy named Neil Boyce, and we had an old horse named I'm drawing a blank on his name. He loved the mud, and that's the only horse I'd ever really been associated with Breeders' Cup. Was galloping this horse going into the Breeders' Cup Sprint the year Gulch won it. Anyway, Drama worked the Saturday before the Breeders' Cup, and he worked so sensational. I had as much confidence in going into that race as any trainer would with any horse going in any race. He was so on his game. And the only thing that was so disappointing is when he drew the one post.
Yeah.
And you could have heard a pin drop when we were when he drew the one, and our whole table just went, because we were just so disappointed we drew the one post. And I'll never forget, I'm walking down the winner's circle, and Todd looks at me. Todd Price looks at me and goes, guess the one post didn't bother you, did it? I go, no. he couldn't have been doing any better when we were going to that race. I had so much confidence in him. And not having a saddle in the Breeders' Cup horse, you got to be a little nervous about your chances. But I was just, I thought he was the horse to beat in the race.
You know, earlier you mentioned Mr. Lieblong and winning with Duke of Mischief at Oaklawn for him. How special was it to win for Harold Queen in the Breeders' Cup?
Oh, it was unbelievable. Both races were really races you will never forget. I mean, Mr. Lieblong's been racing in Arkansas for years. He's part of the Arkansas Racing Board, and his heart's in Arkansas racing. And it was such a great pleasure to win for him. And again, with Harold, I mean, he bred and raised that horse.
Yeah.
He wasn't, and talking to Harold after the fact, he had, he was a finicky baby when he was little. They had some little issues with his stomach and stuff real early on that Harold babied him so much. And Harold had a lot of confidence in that horse from the very beginning.
But he's such a beautiful horse. I mean, he really, he's the kind of horse.
When he worked before the Breeders' Cup, he worked 46 flat at Calder. Calder was gracious enough to go up there before the group of horses came up, gave us a like 5-minute head start. And he breezed over a freshly Harold racetrack. But when Cohen came back, and in fact, I was standing with Frank Bertolino, who's been around horses forever. And I had a watch in my hand. Frank had no idea how fast the horse went. I said, Frank, how'd he go? Frank looks, he looked like he went about 49. And we got back to the barn, and I said to Cohen, I said, how'd he go? Oh, 48. He did it really easy. It was nothing. I said, try 46 flat. He just did it, and the kid never moved on him. He was literally had his, literally just a nice snug hold on him, and it was an unbelievable move that morning.
How difficult was it for you to come to the barn after he's retired? You see that stall, that empty stall, that had to be somewhat difficult for you.
Oh yeah, I mean you always miss those kind of horses, and we made an attempt at the Breeders' Cup the following year, but it was time. He had done his job. I'll tell you what was a really fun experience was when he won the Mr. Prospector that year, following the Breeders' Cup the day before the Eclipse Awards.
Yep.
That was just an unbelievable race. That was almost as thrilling as winning the Breeders' Cup.
Really? How come?
Well, I mean, he ran 120 buyer number. He ran a negative 3 on the sheets and an 8 on the black box. He ran the fastest race of the year.
Wow.
Yeah. I didn't realize that. I knew it was quick.
Oh, yeah, it was just an incredible race. And to watch him, you know, just run away from those horses. It was great. But you always miss those kind of horses. I mean, Duke has only been retired a week, and I miss him already.
Yeah.
You know, but you miss those kind of, and if you're fortunate enough that you can you get an opportunity to get more of those kind of horses.
Outside,
you know, facing in South Florida, we have been very, very fortunate.
David, outside of horses like 41 Carats and Duke of Mischief and Big Drama, who are a couple of others that really stick out to you and kind of hold a special place in your heart for whatever reason?
Well, you know, Take the Tour was my first grade one winner. She was a very nice filly. She won, the Shuby, and then she came back and won the Phipps 2 years in a row. And she was a really nice mare. And, you know, being that she was my first, grade one winner, obviously she sticks in my head. And, you know, I've had, a few other horses of my own that have been fun. And, you know, I can remember a lot of my horses over the years that were just a lot of fun to have at the time. You know, and I'll tell you, I've been really blessed with some great clients. I mean, I mentioned Walter New earlier. He passed away last year.
Yep.
But Sandy, his wife, is still in it. We own several horses together. And Mr. Queen and Alice Lieblong. And, you know, Alice has been with me almost 12 years. I mean, they've been really loyal and great clients to have.
Well,
and without the clients, you don't get horses.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But you have such a great attitude. You're always upbeat. You love the game. It's your passion shows through, and I think the owners pick up on that, and they want to have horses with you.
Yeah, and like I said, it's also a customer business. You have to try to treat your clients the best you can, and you will find out. You'll find there's some wonderful clients out there.
David, hard to believe we've been talking here for almost a half an hour now. Any bites? Any bites down there? You got anything on the line?
No. It's a perfect day. I mean, we got a nice light breeze and it's overcast a little bit and, 75 degrees, but it's been swell. I would, listen to the radio and a lot of the other captains are crying too. So we're not the only ones out here not doing much.
What do you use for bait?
Right now we're pulling some ballyhoo and we have some cigarmen, some live bait.
All right, we're going to let you go ahead and get back to the fishing. Again, really appreciate you doing this, taking the time here to join us. It's been a lot of fun. Great to hear your story, and can't wait to see you when we get down there for Fountain of Youth this weekend.
We'll see you then. Have a good one.
All right, you too, David.
Good luck.
All right, take care. You bet. Bye.
David Fox, always, always a lot of fun. One of our favorite people to interview.
Oh, yeah, he's a great guy. I mean, just hanging around him, no matter where you see him, if it's at a racetrack party or between races, or he's just got a great attitude. Really fun guy to be around. Excellent horseman, does a great job with the horses. And, you can see it's a family business. Him and his wife spend a lot of time together, and it's just a really great operation.
I was so glad that you brought up our first time meeting David Fox at Calder, because that was such a great experience. I'll never forget it. I've never had a trainer, when you walk up and you meet them for the first time, usually we'll go up and ask them if we can do an interview for the show or something like that. And that's what we were doing. We had the microphone ready to go for David. And he said, come on, let me give you a little tour. And he took us down his shed row and showed us all the horses and then allowed me to get into the stall with Little Drama, Drama's brother, which I thought was pretty neat and cool for him to do that, because he didn't know us at all.
And he's very open, and he just is engaging and great to the press, and very, very cool guy, really.
And the story about him vanning his horses all over.
I love that. It's like the
how cool is that?
Like the David Fox tour, I can just see him pulling the horse out in some little town. Oh, you want to see the horse that won the Breeders' Cup? That would be so David Fox like, Pretty cool.
Well, this has been a very quick hour. It's been an awful lot of fun. A great visit in the first half with trainer Michael Matz, hearing his story, and then, of course, David Fox here in the second half of the show. If you did miss any portion of it, there will be a podcast available on our website by tomorrow morning. You'll get a chance to listen to our trainer talk at your leisure, and you can also do it at Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. We're going to be back here Thursday afternoon while Jude and I will be live from Gulfstream. Ella Starr, Puffy, Sean Feld going to be here in studio, and we're going to look forward to bringing you our coverage 3 to 7 Eastern time. Our listener call-in show is the final furlong show on Thursday. Sure, there's going to be a lot of Derby talk coming up tomorrow afternoon.
Absolutely. Are you kidding? With all those races this weekend?
All right, we're out of here. We got a flight to catch. For our producer, Lee Della Pina, JT Ponte for the Pick 4, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you tomorrow live from Gulfstream on HRN.
Good night, Barbados.